Hi, Melminder, are you okay?
Hi, Dean. Hello, everybody. Sorry for the delay. I was trying to sign on. So,
I was just having a joke with him saying that you were fashionably late.
yeah,
But
I thought I'm trying not to be.
I said that you were looking after patients and clients, so it's all good.
Yeah.
Melminder, I just wanted to get you on here. Firstly, just a recap for everyone to know the amazing work that you're doing. Obviously, we work together on a lot of things. We're doing our workshop,
Yeah,
which is
absolutely.
great,
Yeah,
Mental
yeah.
Health and You. So we're going around businesses, speaking to people about my experience and about the other side of the therapy table. So you giving
Yeah.
your experience as well. I think it's a time where we really need to be speaking openly about anxiety with everything that's happening again within the world. It seems like it's a never-ending cycle of negativity. What you're seeing in the therapy room, is there any patterns that you're seeing at the moment?
So, well, anxiety is just one of those things that sort of started to rise up again during lockdown. And then we were all let out of lockdown, and then it's kind of surged again. So, I've been treating anxiety for over 10 years. So, for me, I see it all the time. So, what am I seeing different, I guess, in the last sort of 3 to 6 months is actually a lot of relationship anxiety, a lot of it. So, following on from big life changes that people were sort of making in the background during lockdown, during COVID, and then surfacing out of lockdown, feeling anxious about the decisions that they secretly made, that they things that they want to change, or the group of people who've gone ahead and made those changes. So big life changes such as changing jobs, starting a new career, ending a relationship, these sorts of things I'm seeing a lot of, in particular this year.
That's
And
interesting.
those sorts of changes tend to historically take place in Christmas time and in January, after people have had a bit of a break. And then they occur again in September after the summer holiday break. So they're the two points in the year where I would see people wanting to make big life changes that accompany, and what accompanies that is a huge amount of anxiety. But in the last 6 months, I've just seen that. So that's a really marked change that I've seen. And, you know, why is that happening? Well, anxiety feeds off the unknown. And when you're about to make a big life change, or at least a life change for yourself, there's a huge amount of unknown there. So that, you know, I would say that's more of an expected anxiety. But I also treat people who get anxious unexpectedly, you know, generalized anxiety, that sort of thing as well.
Just for people who don't know what generalized anxiety is, we often get, and I'm sure you see it on Instagram as well. You see, oh, the difference between a panic attack, which is obviously the fight, flight, or freeze response, the end of an anxiety cycle, and an anxiety attack. Now we know that there's no medical term for anxiety attack, but with general anxiety, it tends to be like almost this simmer of anxiety that doesn't go away or doesn't seem like the person has any respite from it. Yeah, can you just explain what generalized anxiety is for the people that are watching?
Just following off what you've just described, actually, there's just no reference point for it, you know, and which makes it even more confusing, and therefore, you know, a huge opportunity to continue getting anxious because you just don't know what's setting it off. So when there's no reference point, so usually, like I said, like I started off with a big life change, yes, you know, there will be anxiety. Driving test or exam test, you know, there's a reason for it. Or even if you have a fear or a phobia of escalators, elevators, shopping centers, public transport, you know what it is. You know, I am anxious because of this, you know. But with generalized anxiety, there is no reference point. It can be, it's just there simmering like underneath, and it can be for you're just on high alert.
It's almost like one day that they wake up and they fight, the anxiety response has just become sensitized, and they're going through the day and everything that around them can be seen, or the brain interprets as a threat. So it could be you're outside and then it suddenly gets windy, and then that wind causes anxiety because of the change. It could be that you are in a room that suddenly becomes noisy, and then that noise change restarts the anxiety. It can really be really a big struggle throughout the day for a lot of people.
Yeah, like you said, it could be subtle things, changes in temperature, changes in weather, changes in sound and volume and things like that. Absolutely. And, you know, so those are things that are outward in. You know, we're experiencing those in our local environment. They're coming in and they're causing some level of anxiety. But it can also be thoughts about what's going on. You know, you might just be sitting in a waiting room and just looking out the window or something mindlessly, and bam, suddenly starting feeling a little bit anxious.
Yeah.
You know, so your mind's then held on some. Somebody had a quick question here, Dean. I don't know if we're answering questions.
Answering questions. There's over 30 of them already fell off.
There was a great question here, and I wanted to pick it up because I think it a lot of people ask it. The question was, when does generalized anxiety become depression? At which point?
Interesting. Right? Yeah.
Excellent question. I get asked that a lot. So I would say the official, from the NHS or the UK government guidelines, the official definition of when depression can start is after 2 weeks of certain feelings, like feeling a little bit hopeless, helpless, you know, those sorts of things, and loss of interest in activities that you used to get joy in, a reduction in social activities or engaging with your friends and things like that. And if that goes on for more than a couple of weeks, you know they would say, the guidelines would say, you're on the verge of this starting to take foot now. Anxiety and depression, unfortunately, are comorbid. After a while, when you have one, you might get the other. There's a 70% chance that you will. So when does anxiety get into depression? So I would say when the anxiety affects your day to day. Sometimes we can live with it and just get on with it, or, you know, we have some pretty neat and nifty control mechanisms or avoidance mechanisms that might not be the best, but you can still function day to day. You can get on with your life. But the moment that anxiety starts to interrupt your day-to-day functioning, you know, for more than a few weeks, there's a chance that that interruption to your day-to-day life will start to shut your world down. You will potentially reach out to your friends much less. You will go out much less. You will do the normal thing because of the anxiety. Mm-hmm. Now, after 2 weeks of feeling hyper anxious, you know, and avoiding things and controlling things because it's interrupting your day to day, then followed by 2 or 3 weeks of, you know, not going out, not speaking to your friends, not going to the gym or trampolining or cooking class or whatever it is that you do for fun, or even avoiding work. Those two things now, the anxiety and the depression, they kind of, unfortunately, start to mold together, and it starts to become a negative spiral in and of itself. So, it, you know, it's sad to say it, but within a couple of months, it can turn quite unbearable, you know, and unthinkable in that way.
But the good news is that they're both highly treatable,
which is the hope
that we give to the community, that even if it does spiral into depression, that doesn't mean that you're not going to overcome it. Depression and anxiety are both highly treatable, but sometimes there's just a different treatment methods for each one, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's such a strong point. Like, I've had clients who sadly have lived with anxiety and depression for months or even years before seeking therapy. Yeah. And when they start therapy, the first thing they say is, why didn't I do this before?
Do they give a reason why they didn't?
So they normally say that with elation, that, oh, why didn't I start this before? I should have started this before. Da, 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 da. And I don't always ask unless that information's volunteered. But I can only guess, you know, where people don't tell me. You know, sometimes it is because couldn't find the right therapist, or couldn't find a therapist, or timing wasn't right, finances weren't right, in between jobs, kids, family, whatever, right? Yeah. Life gets in the way. But I think, I suspect one of the major reasons that people don't seek therapy early on is because they don't know how much it can actually help.
Okay.
You know, so, and I think when people say, oh, they're very elated that it's helped, I think that's because they're thinking more of, you know, if I had known I could address this issue and work through it and move through it and come out better, if I knew it was just this I needed to do, I would have done it sooner. And then also admitting to yourself, like knowing that actually it is an issue. And this is where I think your community and what you're doing on Instagram is great, because you're actually, you know, going some way to sort of help people identify it within themselves. And I think sometimes we just get so lost in our
thoughts. Away the shame from it as well.
Yeah, take away the shame. But sometimes we get so lost, because you might start out here day one a little bit anxious, and then it kind of seeps in slowly, especially with generalized anxiety, right? It just seeps in so slowly. Sure. In a few weeks you might be someplace, you're like, oh, how did I get here?
Yeah, and you don't realize often, like you say, and then you're battling with it.
Yeah, and then you look back and think, wow, I haven't been happy in a long time. I haven't been calm in a long time. What's going on? And that's when the clients will tend to identify with, well, what is this? Is it that I'm just getting older and this is what happens, you know? Or is there something else going on? What I'm feeling is I'm not feeling like I used to feel. Yeah,
and that's important. And that's when it needs to be addressed. So I'm going to get with the questions, Malminda. We'll just do one, like you do one, then I'll do one. So I'll just do them randomly. So this is for you, the first one. So what's the best DIY self-healing for trauma / shadow work?
Oh, that's a great question. So I would say that is one of the challenging things. Shadow work and trauma, that is, I would say, super challenging to do on a do-it-yourself type thing, because you normally need someone, a therapist, to be able to see what you can't see, you know, hence the shadow. But also specifically with trauma patients, when the brain goes into trauma, it almost goes into lockdown mode, so you might not be able to access the same sort of memory from the traumatic experience, because your mind just goes into block. You don't know what happened, or you're just stuck at the most traumatic, at the peak of the traumatic experience. So with trauma in particular, there's a lot of a lot of little dark spots everywhere, because when someone's going in the process of going through like if I was going through a traumatic experience right now, because part of my brain would go into shutdown mode, I won't be focused on the full here and now, a little bit like anxiety, we're not fully present, and because of that it's very hard to work on by yourself later on. So one of the best things anyone can learn from a self-help point of view is to learn and explore what calms you. Go on a little sort of rampage of exploring different things and find out what calms you. Is it a colouring in book? Is it meditation? Is it listening to certain kinds of music? Is it getting out in nature? Is it rubbing ice on your wrists or a cold shower. What is it?
I often say for people when they had hobbies when they were younger that they may not do now because they're older, it's always good to go back in time and try and re-engage with these hobbies that they had so much fun with. There's a lot of science that says that that's very beneficial.
Yeah, hence the adult colouring books, which have just, become hugely popular. Yeah, and I mean, for some people, the trauma is in childhood, so you've got to be a little bit careful there.
Someone's just put, what if nothing around you calms you?
Then I would say, yeah, you have to try and find something. There will be something. Breathing, learning to regulate your breathing is one of the most common ways, but of course that doesn't help everybody. Sometimes that creates more anxiety, but it might be worth looking into.
I think it only creates more anxiety because of the frustration of maybe it hasn't worked. It's a tool that needs to be practiced. With diaphragmatic breathing, I think it is excellent, but I don't think someone should start it when they're in the middle of a panic attack. Should be doing it maybe 3 times a day when they're not anxious, getting the body used to breathing correctly. Yeah. And then after, like anything, when you learn this technique, when you're anxious, your body will just do it. It will change the breathing pattern. I think that's where the confusion comes.
That's an important point. Exactly. So when clients see me and people who are anxious, the first thing I say is, look, I'm going to teach you this breathing technique and you're going to hate me for it, but I want you to practice it 3 times for 5 minutes every single day for the next 2 weeks. And you might not even get close to doing it properly until day 14. That's okay, because you've been fairly anxious and the anxiety, your body has a memory of the anxiety in the body. So it's going to take a while to sort of repattern that a little bit. But I just wanted to talk back about my earlier point, because somebody asked about if you can't find anything. Now, colours, it sounds really basic and daft, but sort of immersing yourself in certain colours can, and I mean like looking into a certain colour, can have a relaxing effect on the brain chemistry and on some people as well. So breathing is one way, but what you want to look for is trying to bring in all of as many different senses as you can. So if you tend to be more of an auditory person, trying to find something like that can calm you in that way. If you're visual, colors, soft shapes, slow movement, that sort of thing.
So it's just really finding what works for you. And just regarding trauma, because there is criticism online that trauma as a word is thrown around and people use it left, right and center. From a therapist's point of view, what is the definition of trauma? And is it an individual approach, or is there a specific definition that equals trauma?
That's a great question. That's one I'm hearing a lot of therapists and even thought leaders trying to redefine that. So I was at a trauma and addiction conference in a couple of weeks ago on the 10th of March, and they were bouncing around ideas there as well. I would go back to what trauma is for you as an individual. Now, some people will say, well, it's experiencing something really horrible and shocking for at least 15 minutes.
Right.
And that can be trauma, right? And some people will say, oh, well, it has to be a really big, big, horrible, disgusting thing that everybody in society will look at and say, that's a horrible thing that's happened. That's definitely trauma. So that's more of the global sort of societal view on what trauma is. Things like witnessing a murder, rape, physical violence, that sort of thing. Those are what have been traditionally taught as traumatic experiences, in the 70s and the 80s. But I think, like you said, like you started off with, now trauma is a word that's been bounced around here and there. They got my coffee order wrong. How traumatic, and all of it, you know, and it kind of waters down the experience that people have had. So I would say it is only just a word. It's your relationship to the word,
yeah,
and what you feel defines trauma for you. And that's exactly the place that I work with clients when I see them, because some people will come in and say, oh, the most traumatic thing happened to me and I want to work on that. And I hear that what they have saying doesn't necessarily fit into the traditional or the 80s definition of trauma, you know, but for that person it was, you know, and they're the ones living in their mind with all the thoughts and the feelings and things. And so that's what I'm working with. So I take very much a person-centered approach on this.
No, that's fantastic. And that really makes sense. Like you say, it's just a word. So that really makes sense. I really like that answer. Next question is, so there's a lot of trauma questions, actually.
Yeah.
Here we go. So I'll answer this question. Can the memories that went blank due to anxiety be brought back? 100% yes. So when you're anxious and in that state of anxiety, brain fog, when this occurs, short-term memory loss is very, very common. It can be very scary because you can be in the middle of a sentence and just literally stop and blank out. And just that process can then create more anxiety. And that's really, really important to remember and to know. Because later on, what you'll find is that the anxiety starts to go down. And then what happens is you remember the situation. So it's just the short-term memory.
Yeah.
It's because of the high levels of anxiety.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of the chemicals that are being released within that moment. And it's just interfering with the memory at that time. So 100% yes, there's nothing wrong with your memory. It's literally just the anxiety cycle. Next question for you, Malminder. Oh, this is a good question. How do you deal with nocturnal panic attacks and why do they happen?
Oh, great question. So let's start off with why do they happen, right? let's start off with that. And then I'll go on to how to deal with those. So what, yeah, exactly. Why do they happen? I mean, it's the thing with panic attacks is it is still a bit of a mystery because there's no A plus B equals this for a lot of people. Sometimes you might get a panic attack when you're in certain situations on the bus or you see a spider or something like that, but you can reason with it. You know, I felt that way because I was sitting on a plane and I, you know, and there's a story, there's a narrative,
yes,
that sort of concludes with a panic attack.
Yes.
With nocturnal panic attacks, what I have found when I've treated clients with this is it's very much linked in with the circadian rhythm and it's very much linked in with what the person is doing in the daytime. And when it's happened more than a couple of times, most people with nocturnal panic attacks or any panic attacks will start to think, oh, that wasn't a one-off, so it's
yes,
going to happen again. And then we create this expectation because we're humans and we're patterning, predicting machines. It was an awful experience. So we want to kind of like look out for all of the things that could go wrong, that could create another panic attack. And now with nocturnal, it's extra special because you don't have any distractions. It's usually at nighttime, in the middle of the night, you might wake up with a panic attack.
Yes.
Or you might
so
have
it's like a surge of cortisol, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it's usually well, a huge surge of cortisol. That's why I say a circadian rhythm thing. So when I see clients for that now, I always try and get them to test their hormones as well.
Right.
To see what's happening with their cortisol levels, because usually sometimes it can be a bit back to front, and that needs resetting, which means sleep needs resetting, which means you have to look at when you're eating and what you're eating.
Also, people don't realize when they're going through an anxiety disorder that they don't get enough deep sleep. So they're in this state of light sleep and REM. So a lot of anxious people, they'll remember the dreams. They often have disturbing dreams or reoccurring dreams. And like you say, waking up in the middle of the night, it is very, very common. Nocturnal panic attacks, it is very common. Does the unconscious mind know a pattern?
I would say, just going back to my earlier point, once something like a panic attack's happened, whether it's nocturnal or daytime, because it's such a, you know, it's a horrible physical and mental experience, we go into the thing of we don't want that to happen again. And because it's so out of the ordinary in our day-to-day life, so jarring to experience that and so horrible, loss of control, loss of your mind, loss of your physical senses, you know, it's almost like a part of our mind trying to prevent it from happening again. And that's where the unconscious sort of kicks in, like, oh, that happened, we don't want that to happen again, so let's be overprotective. And that's when people will fall into the trap of avoiding trying to control too much. So what?
Well, how can you avoid a nocturnal panic?
I was just about to say that.
If it's happening.
Get into that. So with nocturnal, what I've seen, what clients will do to try and avoid it or to control it is they'll have the lights on and the telly on.
Right.
You know, sometimes they'll try and not sleep at night and try and catch some sleep during the daytime. Okay. Sometimes they will only, they won't sleep in the bedroom, they'll sleep in the living room, or they'll insist on sleeping with, you know, somebody else in the bed, you know, like a trusted family member or, you know, their partner, especially if they're sleeping in different rooms. You know, they'll go through lots of different things to sort of mitigate the fear. Right.
So it's exactly the same as the sort of behavior that we see during the daytime with panic attacks. Yeah. So they're doing this behavior to avoid it in their mind, try and avoid, mitigate the situation from happening. But we know that behavior, all it does is pour fuel onto the anxiety disorder and keeps it recurring.
Keeps it recurring. Absolutely. So how to deal with that? That's a great question. I usually, when I see clients, it is all hypnotherapy I do with nocturnal anxiety, directly speaking to the unconscious mind under hypnosis to sort of interrupt that pattern and try to restore a pattern of calm. You know,
so I was yesterday speaking to Dr. Amon, who's renowned in our field, and he really banged home how important hypnotherapy is in treating anxiety.
Yeah. I love Dr. Amon. Now, yeah.
I think there's a lot of stigma still around hypnotherapy. For people who don't understand and realize how hypnotherapy helps anxiety, can you just give a brief explanation of why everybody's saying how great it is?
So, I mean, hypnotherapy as a therapy modality by definition actually includes relaxation, right? Yes, normally. So just by the very nature of having hypnotherapy, it takes you through a process of relaxation. So that already is a great antidote for anxiety, because it's just taking you from an anxious state and then teaching you and your subconscious mind how to be calm, how to relax, you know. So with the therapy portion of hypnosis, you know, that's where we, you know, a hypnotherapist like myself would use, you know, I don't tend to use suggestion-based therapy, which is you will do this or you will do that, and when you wake up, you will feel this or you will feel that. I don't particularly use that. I tend to use more storytelling, sometimes association, disassociation, sometimes timeline, sometimes, you know, going back into the past, sometimes parts therapy. So I'm using some, you know, psychotherapy under hypnosis. That's the way I do it. Mm-hmm. But the general umbrella is to relax and calm, relax and calm. And this is often a bit of a conscious exercise, like teaching clients how to relax themselves. Right. You know, it's like an education piece. We're not taught that, are we? Parents
don't tend to teach us that. No, we're really not.
And at school, we don't learn it either.
And when going through an anxiety disorder, you forget what relaxation is. So I can imagine that, like, again, the relief of when people are seeing you, of that it's bringing them so much calm, because they've literally been in an anxiety cycle for God knows how long.
Yeah. And because, well, can I just say, Dean, because we haven't necessarily, a lot of us, we haven't grown up with the tools on how to calm ourselves and relax ourselves, we kind of just like plod along in life. Everything's fine, da, 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 bam, something happens, we get anxious, we don't have the tools, and then we're like, what's going on?
Yes.
Right? And then that, when you're at the peak of anxiety, at the peak of panic, and then you say, oh, the breathing's not working, or these calming and relaxation things aren't working, they won't work. It's too much of a jump. So whenever anybody during the week feels just a little bit more calmer than before, so they don't have to be like proper zen, but a little bit more calmer than before, at their calm point, their possible calmish, that's when you start practicing the breathing techniques, or start practicing coloring books, or this, that, and the other. That's when you do it, because what you're doing in that moment is you're building up a reserve. You're building up a blueprint for your subconscious mind. This is my relaxation activity. This is what I do when I'm relaxing.
Yes.
You know, it's a bit like when we jump into a pool, we do this because what we do is swimming, right?
Yes.
When we stand up after sitting down, what we do is usually walking. And that all took practice, right? So it's the same. So try and find time in your week just where you're calmer than before to put that blueprint in your mind, and it's gonna take a bit more effort than a few goes, so you have to stick at it.
Know what some people are gonna say, Malminder, and that is that they don't feel calm, that they get up and they're dealing with anxiety 24/7. I hear that so much. And I think that's just the inner narrative that's really fueling that they're thinking that there is no respite, because I understand, I've been there before, it feels like there isn't, but there is going to be moments, isn't there?
And I agree, it does feel like that, but what I'm saying is, if it feels like 10 out of 10 anxiety all the time, I want you to just, what I'm suggesting is to practice something calming and relaxing when it feels like 9.5 out of 10.
Yes.
Or 9.9 out of 10.
Yeah.
Right? Because there will be a point where it's even marginally less.
Yes.
And then you practice it there. And next time you reach that point, you practice it again. Next time you practice it again. And you might find over time, oh, now it's 9.3 or 9.2. So that's my point, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really good point. We've probably got time for another two questions, if that's all right with you, Malminder.
Yes, that's fine.
Let me have a look. Let's see if I can get some good ones. Oh, this is a great one. Great one for you, Malminder. What if I have bad therapy experience gives you anxiety to reach out again?
Yeah, that's a really good one. Is that question put, are you going to put that one up? No, hold on.
It is up. Well, it's on my screen.
Oh, right. Okay. It's probably coming up. So the question was, if you've had bad therapy experience,
gives you anxiety to reach out again. So this person, they've been to therapy, had a bad experience. Now they're in a position that they want therapy, but they're too anxious to go through that experience again.
Yeah, that's understandable if you have had a bad experience. I would start off with, so the desire to want therapy seems pretty strong in that person's question. So that's a good thing. But there's a parallel thought that's running, which is, I guess, what if the next therapist I meet I have a similar experience. Mm-hmm. What if the next therapist can't help me, or I don't gel with them, or the next therapist berates me or puts me down or questions or whatever the issue was? And that's really, really understandable, because when you have therapy, you know, you're in a vulnerable situation and you want to be, you know, safe and secure, right? So I would recommend for if you're in that situation to interview therapists on the phone first before committing, and interview like 10 or 15.
I love that idea.
Yeah, like of that sort of number, and don't push them, don't do all those phone calls on one day. Like, take your time over it, because if you're seeking counselling or psychotherapy, you're usually going to be in counselling or psychotherapy for half a year or a year. So you want to make sure that you gel with the person. And actually, it might be well worth mentioning your fears or concerns about going to therapy again to your therapist when you're interviewing them.
And a good therapist, from knowledge, is that they will say to a client, if they feel that what they can bring to the table wouldn't be as beneficial as maybe another therapist would, and actually recommend another therapist.
Yeah, absolutely.
There is some amazing therapists out there, and I know that obviously the amazing work that you do, and you're not shy to say no. Maybe there's someone else who'll deal with this situation
better. I say that
better.
In the first phone call. The first thing I say in the you know, usually the initial few minutes is, tell me a little bit more about it. And if I feel it's something I can help with, I'll let you know. If I don't think it's my bag, I will definitely try my best to refer you on.
And
it has to be that way, because it needs to be. It's a very intimate relationship here, yes. Therapist and client, and I think I would hope most therapists do take that that thinking and thought going forward, because you know, from my point of view, I really don't want a client that I don't believe I can do anything with, and that's going to be, you know, like a positive outcome. Yeah. Because you're on the back foot on the get-go. And then also, you're not going to gel with every therapist's personality.
No.
You know, and yeah, just exactly. Because we're therapists doesn't
and
mean
it's, yeah,
our
it's
personality's
okay,
perfect.
It's okay maybe two or three sessions into it to reevaluate. And if it's not working for you, it's okay to then move on and get someone and like you say, go through that interview process and change therapy.
And most therapists are in supervision themselves weekly.
Yes.
I am, and so you know, we're used to it. You won't hurt our feelings, you know. You know, we're used to it, and if we do feel hurt, then we take it to our supervisor, right? Because we're you know, to try and keep a clear canvas. Dr. David Jack has joined. He's an aesthetics doctor that works in my building.
Oh, fantastic. Hello to what was he called?
Dr. David Jack. I have the Mindful Facial with his clinic, where you have a live hypnotherapy session and one of Dr. David Jack's facialists doing a facial.
Oh, fantastic. So. I may have seen him when I've been down.
Dean, when you're next in London, you have to have it. I think that'll be a good experience for you.
Yes, definitely. So the last question, Malminder. What about the vision issues? Since I've been experiencing anxiety for so long, it gives me tunnel vision. Now, I know I can relate when I was going through anxiety about the tunnel vision. And also with myself, it was a hyper-sensitive, so it almost made everything brighter in the situation I was in. It wasn't like a tunnel vision. For me, it was... everything was just more vivid. It was like someone had turned the color up on the situation I was in. So I know that there is different experiences of when them chemicals are running through the body. Yeah. And someone's put blurred vision as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is all what's going on in the body. And then the outlet's coming through the eyes. And then you're seeing blurred, brighter colors, tunnel vision, maybe the onset of a headache and you know, dizziness, you know, vertigo even, you know, or a vibration or a buzzing feeling, you know, completely flooding the body. And these are all the hormones that are just running wild through the body, and then you need an outlet.
What do you say to people who say, I know that I need to sit with the anxiety or acknowledge the anxiety, but I just can't do it. I have to move away from the situation. I need it to stop. What do you say to them people?
So when they're in a situation that sort of creates anxiety, and then they go to avoidance?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So I would say in that sort of situation, stick out a little bit longer than you normally would do.
Okay.
To prove to yourself that you're okay. So if in that sort of situation you would try and exit it immediately, try and count to 30 in your head and then leave.
Right.
Next time you're in that situation, count a little bit more or a little bit more. So in a sense, you're doing self-exposure therapy.
Yeah, and gradual self-exposure.
And through time, that will rack up, and it will start to feel, oh, actually, I was all right.
Yeah, because what you want to teach the brain is that the situation you're in isn't dangerous. I know that when I was going through it, I used to believe it. I used to have a bath for relaxation in the evening, part of my sleep hygiene routine. However, one of the nights I got anxious in the bath, and what did I do? I got out, and I then, as you do with human behavior, I started taking showers and I was avoiding having a bath.
Yeah.
And it really, and the next time I went in the bath, guess what happened? I got anxious.
Yeah.
So it doesn't take a lot for these patterns to build up and for people to really spiral and start to avoid everyday situations that are not dangerous.
Yeah, that does happen. Absolutely, exactly like that experience. And why does it happen so quickly? It's really because there was a strong association created with that experience, plus elevated anxiety, something yes. out of the ordinary. So you're bobbling along in your everyday life, sometimes a little bit blue, sometimes a little bit happy, sometimes meh, you know, and then suddenly you start to feel anxious, and it could be all, you know, for whatever reason, holding a pen or something. And then because you've had that experience and your brain is looking or experience, or your body's experiencing something, there comes the attachment. And then it's like, oh, now to prevent that from happening, Dean doesn't go into the bathtub anymore. Yeah. So Dean's having showers. And what happens over time, you know, this is exactly the beginning of it. What happens over time, you start to close and close and close. And then if you had an experience like that in the shower, I'm not suggesting that, but if that did happen, then it would be like, oh, you know.
I need to get that flannel out. I need to start washing in the basin.
Well, I mean, we're laughing about it, but that's exactly how it starts. And then before you know it, it's disrupted your day to day. You have that for a few weeks.
Yeah.
You know, you'll stop going out because you're like, oh, I smell. People are going to notice I smell, or something, this, that, and the other, or I feel embarrassed. And then you're somewhere else a couple of months later. So it does start pretty quick, but there's so many things that can be done about it. And that's important to remember.
I'm such a big believer in exposure therapy. I think it, for panic disorder, I think it's just a life-saving tool to just reprogram the brain by having all these correct tools that you can use, and just putting yourself in the situation. And I know that you believe the number one rule: if it's not a dangerous situation, and you can possibly stay in it, try not to leave the situation.
Yeah, just try. The early example I gave is if it's a situation that you're facing regularly, and then you stay a little bit longer, a little bit longer, a little bit longer. But if it's a situation that isn't so common in your life, then what you want to do, let's say it's like at a festival, you know, or something like that. Yeah, we're not going to festivals usually every week, right? Yeah. So let's say it's something like at a festival. In that situation, you know, try and stay as long as you can, you know, move to a different part of the festival or the concert or whatever. And then once you feel better, just inch yourself closer and then you can come out of it, but then keep going back so that, you know, not to, you know, just think in your mind, I don't want this to be the beginning of something. So I will need to teach my mind that I'm going to be okay.
Just before we leave, I know a lot of people ask about driving anxiety, and I want to know, just want to hear your take on it. So someone gets anxious on a motorway, they're unable to pull over. What's your advice for them? Are they in a dangerous situation? Because often they feel they've got these thoughts that they're losing control, that the anxiety is going to escalate and it's going to make them lose control. What's your advice for them if they're driving and they get anxious?
Yeah, I would say as soon as it's safe to do so, to pull over.
Okay.
So that you can manage your anxiety, because in that sort of situation, starts off in the thoughts and then it tends to start to filter down into sometimes like a physical anxiety. And lots of people with driving anxiety know that they have it because they've had it before while they've been driving, right? And so that's why it's very important to look at how to manage and cope with the anxiety before reaching the point where you're in the car. Right. So that's something I want to distinguish here, and that's really important because I do see a lot of driving anxiety, and the ones with driving anxiety that come to seek help for therapy or even start searching things on Google are usually somebody who's had it a good few times.
Right.
Now, as soon as you've had it once, that's the time to sort of look at how to manage it. Not at the 10th time. I mean, you can do it, and I recommend you still do, but I'm saying the first time it happened is already enough for you to look at how to manage it.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Very good point. Yeah. Now, someone was asking, I've seen they've asked about 10 times in the comments, how do they get access for resources on somatic anxiety? Would you know any?
Yes. Goodness me. Can I send you the link? Because my supervisor was talking about that literally a couple of months ago, and she sent me the link. There's a it's a link with a directory of a bunch of different therapists that specialize in somatic therapy. So Dean, if I give that link to you, you can post it on stories.
Sure, on the stories, of course.
Yeah, I don't know it off the top of my head, but it is something that I was talking about with my supervisor. So I don't know the answer just yet, but we'll have it soon.
Someone just put people talking about the driving anxiety. What works for them is grounding themselves while they're driving. So putting on the favorite songs. Singing words like a mantra to themselves that can almost break the cycle. So are you saying if these people feel comfortable, well, obviously they don't feel comfortable, but they feel like they've been through the anxiety before, they know what it is, so they want to continue to drive, in your opinion, are they okay to do that?
It depends.
Okay.
It depends, because sometimes it's a little flurry of anxiety and nerves, which are well managed, but if you do not feel safe driving,
pull over.
Then definitely pull over as safely as possible. But even before you get into the car, if you really have had this experience for months where you don't feel safe driving, then get therapy, because there's a chance that the anxiety will take you over, and you know. And then it's going to be really difficult to manage. So another thing, actually, singing is a good one. And that's because when you sing, it sort of stimulates your vagus nerve. The vagus nerve runs through the body, and it's basically your calming, relaxing nerve that just kind of takes things down a notch or two. If you don't want to sing, another good one is to hum.
Yeah.
That will also get the vagus nerve going as well. So that was a good thing somebody just pointed out in the chat. Absolutely, singing something to stimulate the vagus nerve. Very easy to do.
And also self-massaging the vagus nerve can be used, not in the car, obviously, when you're driving, but as part of a sleep routine can be useful as well. Malvinda, where can everybody find you if they don't follow you on Instagram? Yeah. How can they access therapy? I know that you offer it worldwide, and you offer a free consultation call to make sure that therapy is the right fit for them and yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So I offer a complimentary call to everybody that books in. I offer therapy here in London. I travel a lot. And actually, Dean, I'm going to LA at the end of April for 2 weeks. So I'll be seeing clients out there as well. And I think, so I try my best to be as flexible as I can with time zones and things like that as well. You can find me on Instagram. That's probably the easiest. Dean and I work together quite a lot. And actually, we're now offering our corporate workshops, which I think you talked about at the start, right?
Yeah. So we're really excited to do.
Yeah,
we've
really
worked separately for big, big companies doing talks, and they've been received very well. So we just thought it was a natural thing to come together and offer it's a different approach. I don't think anyone's doing it. And the feedback we've had has been amazing.
We're already getting booked up. Yeah.
So if anybody in here has a manager, or if you are a manager, and you want this workshop, it's called
Mental Health and You. So it'll be Dean and myself talking about anxiety and our top tips and things that you can do, practical exercises for people in the team to reduce stress, reduce anxiety, covering lots of different topics such as presentation anxiety, performance anxiety, anxiety around conflict with, your colleagues and boss and seniors and juniors and right down to anxiety around, the social anxiety at work as well. Very big, very, very big.
Very huge. And I remember going through an anxiety disorder, the dinner room, where everyone had lunch, was almost like a battlefield in the mind. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. So yeah, really excited to do that. We've got some bookings already, which is fantastic. But if anyone's interested, send me a DM or send Malminder a DM, or you can find it on both of our websites where you can leave your details and we'll be back to you. Yeah. But Malminder, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with
Thank
the community.
You
know that
me.
I love everything that you do. And yeah, I'll catch up with you soon. And yeah, thank you for everything that you do.
Thank you, everybody.
Take care, Malminder.
Bye.